Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we look forward to Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and his observations about various insects. And you're invited to join us in Madison. The number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Phil, it's a pleasure to have you here in the studios again.
Nice to be here, Jim.
Obviously, there's a lot going on in the insect world, making front page news everywhere. One of the stories that I saw that you can shed some light on is this boy from Oregon who was nine, who apparently had found spiders taking up residence in his left ear.
Right. I think the thing that we found to be a little deceptive here is they had talked about two spiders living in his ear and feeding on his earwax. Well, the first thing is spiders eat insects, not earwax. But really what we think was going on, it was one spider that was shedding its skin. Just like insects, they have this exoskeleton that they have to shed on a regular basis. Usually they look for a nice protected place, which an ear would fit. Mm-hmm. And we really suspect the spider crawled in there, did its molting. And when they finally did the purging of it, both the old skin came out and the newly molted spider. And so I think that makes a lot more sense biologically and, again, isn't quite the way it was presented in the press.
So Jesse Courtney, the boy, was given the spiders. So what he has, in effect, then, is a spider.
And the skin. In fact, I remember seeing a little piece on it. He talked about floaty and sinky because one sunk and one floated. Well, as I said, it was just the difference between it. So it was the same spider, just the old skin and the whole new spider. So.
But an unusual exhibit for show and tell at school.
Well, in an experience that not most of us would have in our lifetime of having a spider show up there. But spiders are common enough that I guess this, I'm sure it's happened before.
If the spider continued to live in there, is there a health risk for the boy?
Generally not. We find so often people think they get spider bites and do not. And most spiders are not capable of biting. They can't get their fangs or enough leveraged in order to do it. So I think other than the irritation that potentially could go on, and again, I have a very strong suspicion that once the spider had successfully molted and whatnot, that it would come crawling out on its own.
We offered the numbers, and sure enough, the lines are full. So let's take some phone calls, and we're going to start off, Phil, with Gene in Oshkosh. Gene, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Phil. I had taken this up with the county agent, and of course, your name came up, and said he was going to contact you. I haven't heard anything, so you're on the radio, and I thought I'd contact you directly. What I have is a hypothesis. I don't even have a theory. But we have a back porch, poured concrete, sliding doors all around, and about half the porch is used up with a nice size hot tub. Last fall, a leak occurred, and we called the people, and they took part of it apart, perhaps one-fifth of the siding. And, there's a leak, and they repaired the piping. And then they had to leave it open for perhaps 2 months, maybe 10 weeks, in order to dry out the foam before they came back and refoamed it and put the siding on. Since it has started warming up this spring, our regimen now is every morning to go out there with a dustpan and a whisk broom and pick up dead spiders. We have two different kinds of ant control out there. We have PIC with sodium tetraborate pentahydrate, and then RAID with abramectin. And there must be at least 10 traps on the floor. And obviously, well, I believe the ants are eating the poison and then dying, because virtually all the ants we pick up, pretty good-sized black ants, are dead, so we just go out there. Now, question, is there a nest in there? Should they be eating this poison, taking it back to the nest? How many ants exist in a nest or in some sort of a colony that may be in our hot tub foam? Any suggestions, and how long do we have to keep up picking ants?
Well, it's a little hard to answer other than once you started talking about the foam and ants, we find that carpenter ants commonly move into soft substrates. And although we associate them with rotting wood, I do see them in insulation quite a bit. And one of the things that's hard to determine from what you tell me is, you know, when a carpenter ant colony starts, it's a single queen. And even in the first year, she can only raise a handful of young. And so often to get a large colony, in a large colony could easily number 10,000 or more individuals, takes years. On the other hand, a phenomenon that we see with carpenter ants is if they are living in your trees, that in the summer, these bigger colonies create what are called satellite colonies, where not the queen, but workers and young and even some of the future reproductives go out and move in a summer home, if you want to think of it that way, and then move back in the fall. And I'm very suspicious that that's what's going on here, because it's a relatively recent hot tub and the like. And now, in order for baits to be good, you want them to be slow acting, that the ants pick them up, go back to the nest, feed each other, which is a common behavior with ants. And that still may be going on, but when the workers come back out again to look for more bait, the boric acid or the ivermectin that's in the other bait could be doing them in. So the hard thing for me to tell you is, first, how long it's going to take. And secondly, is it just the ants coming from the hot tub, or are you also recruiting ants from other parts on the property, which is a possibility?
Sealed porch. In other words, our sliding doors in tracks, and I would spray them a couple, three times a year. I don't think there's any ingress at all.
Mm-hmm.
I just think whatever is dying off that we find in the morning seems, I believe, is coming from the hot tub.
Okay. Well, so, and it doesn't even have to be the foam, to be honest. If there are existing void spaces in there, I could see the ants would be very much appealed by the relatively nice, warm, uniform temperatures and some moisture to a degree, because carpenter ants do need some moisture in their colony. And so, as I said, it's a little hard to tell. Now, one of the things that we would often talk about is to try to find the nest, which it's not worth taking the hot tub apart. So you're taking exactly the approach I would suggest, is you bait them, let the bait do the work for you. But I think the only mistake you can make is not providing them bait when there's ant activity. And again, it definitely suggests that this is a well-established, strong colony that is numbering in the thousands. But still, the spring is the best time to bait them. I will be honest, I probably have a little bit more faith in the ivermectin baits than I do the boric acid for carpenter ants in particular. But as long as they're accepting the bait, they show an interest in it. As I said, I think you're going in the right direction to get this under control. But it's something I think you're always going to have to keep your guard up, because you have such an inviting environment for ants to take advantage of.
Gene, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the inquiry. And let's move to Alice in Wind Lake. Hello, Alice. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, good morning. I have probably a few dozen high bush cranberry bushes. And I think I heard something a few years ago where there's some kind of borer or something that's attacking the bushes, and now they've affected mine, and they're totally, some of them are totally dead, and at the base,
yes,
where the stem hits the ground, it's like totally eaten away by something. It's
yeah,
got wormholes, and I'm wondering if I can do anything about that.
Well, the critter is called the viburnum borer, and its claim to fame is attacking the bottom 12 to 14 inches of the plant, and if they do enough physical damage there, the plant will die. They are more common in older bushes, but we do see them in even in new transplants. And so the strategy is basically trying to stop new attacks. And so the treatment time is usually about the 15th of June. And if they're very numerous, there was a gentleman up in the Green Bay area that has done quite a bit of work on just trying to understand the biology. Dave Parsons is the gentleman's name. If they're real bad, I think I would put a second application of this treatment on probably the 15th of July. The product that you will find at the garden stores is, the active ingredient is permethrin. It's P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. And when you treat the basal portion of the plant. There's no reason to treat any other portion. And what you're really doing is killing the moths when they come in to lay eggs, or indeed if they do hatch, catching them before they burrow in. What it will not solve are larvae that are internal inside the stems. They are too well protected by that. But as you can see, you kind of bleed them out over time. And so you may continue to see some decline in the bushes because of pre-existing larvae. but it should get to the point that you should be able to salvage the bushes that have green growth in intact tissue. So,
is permethrin the product that you recommend spraying on the outside of the house for the ladybugs in September?
It is one of the insecticides. Yes, there are. It turns out there's about 8 or 9 that can be sprayed on the outside of the house for lady beetles, but there's only 1 or 2 that are registered for use for viburnivore. So.
Okay, so because I think I might have that. And then what concentration would I put that on?
Just read the label. That one is pretty standard for whatever you treat. There are some insecticides that will have maybe twice as much for certain insects, and borers tend to be harder to kill. But as I said, the information will be there. Just look under viburnum borer, or really any of the boring insects that are listed on the label, the bark beetles, those kind of things. They're all pretty much work the same. And since Dursban has been taken off the home market, permethrin is probably the product of choice for foliar treatments for treating the surface. There are some systemics that work against beetles that bore, but this is not a beetle. This is a moth. So the products like the bear tree and shrub will not work against this insect.
Okay, and I thought of one other question. I have a giant bumblebee that's going in between my deck and the house, and it's right by our patio area. And I'm wondering if there's something I can do, or do I need to call an exterminator?
Well, a couple things to think here. You know, bumblebees start in the spring from a queen, and you're probably seeing the queen, which is often a very large bumblebee. They typically nest in the ground in old rodent burrows or hollowed-out areas. And so there sounds like there's some soil with the like underneath the deck that she's going into. As the summer goes on, there will be more and more bumblebees. Bumblebees, by nature, are pretty docile. I mean, if it's kind of the thing, if it's in a corner of the deck that there's really not much people activity, you could probably let them be. If indeed, though, you know, it's a place where it's right above the grill and you're afraid, the problem is if the nest is threatened, that's when you are most likely to get stung. The trouble here, though, is you're really going to have to look a little bit to find out where the entrance is. If I knew where the bee exactly was going in or had to land on something to crawl in underneath between two boards, I would just dust it with a garden dust called 7. Or you could use a permethrin dust if you had it. The dust is more important than what product you use in this case. The dust tend to work very good for ground nesting bees. But as I said, it's kind of something to evaluate. They're not overly aggressive. As long as you keep the lawnmowers away from them or, you know, the hedge clippers, usually you don't have too much trouble with the nests.
All right, Alice, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri. He's a professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. The telephone number for your call in Madison is 263-1890, and otherwise we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. Or you could use our email address, which is talk@wpr.org. And on we go to Tom in Madison. Tom, what can we do for you?
Well, this morning I got my first mosquito bite in the backyard, and I was wondering if Phil could tell me about the various LP-fired mosquito traps and which ones work better than other ones.
Well, probably, at least in the evaluations I have seen, the mosquito magnet is as good, if not better, than anything else that is typically on the market. And it's been very interesting. When they first came, some of the claims they had really did not have a lot of good, thorough testing. I will tell you that in the last couple of years, last year in particular, there have been some papers published that are a little disappointing from a scientific standpoint. On the other side, I will tell you that people that I have talked to in the last 2 or 3 years have been delighted that have bought them. Now, you know, it's always a numbers game. I guess what we've always felt is in very bad mosquito years, you can collect 90% of them, but if you still have hundreds of mosquitoes in your backyard, you're not going to be satisfied with the trap. What it is basically a mimic for the things that attract humans. And so if you have a trap in your backyard, when you're not there, hypothetically, what you're doing is drawing the mosquitoes that are hiding in your shrubbery to the trap. And you can catch literally hundreds of mosquitoes a night. So I don't question that they catch mosquitoes. Some of the other trap designs have not fared as well. And so I know that the mosquito magnet has outperformed some of the trap designs by 6 to 10 fold in some cases. But as I said, the bottom line, and I think this is kind of where we were sitting until we saw the research that supported this, is in very bad mosquito years, they will not be able to eliminate them to a point that you can enjoy your backyard. So so it's not a waste of money, but it's not 100% effective.
Thank you very much.
All right, Tom. Thank you very much for your call. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri. I'm Jim Packard. Keisha Mabra is on the phones today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about cicadas, honeybees, gypsy moss, and many other insects. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Phil, again, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. So many things going on in the world that are right up your alley.
Boy, it's the last 2 weeks, in fact, really this week, is my phone is kind of went crazy. And there usually is an association between outside air temperature and insect activity. The one thing that I've been seeing, though, is things seem to be a week to 10 days ahead of schedule. We have been seeing some things that I normally wouldn't expect to early June going really quite intense. We've got a lot of things feeding on our pine trees right now, and we've seen some populations of Euonymus caterpillar that are just mind-boggling, where trees have been 100% stripped and literally thousands of worms raining off of it. So I said it's been an interesting spring.
One of our phone producers has a question, which is covered up. Nope, there it is. Has a question about a marigold plant, which has eaten leaves. Not that it's eating them, but the leaves have been eaten.
This spring already?
Yep. And if you'll get off, let me see that. There it is. The veins of the leaves still remain. Now, what could have done this and not have eaten another marigold plant about 3 feet away?
Well, you know, if this was later in the season, I'd be extremely suspicious of earwigs because they absolutely love marigolds. But it's a bit early for that. And so I would be inclined, first of all, to think of slugs. And slugs, you know, do their feeding at night, aren't there during the day? And so that would be my best guess initially. And, slugs are kind of generalist. They feed on almost anything. And it just may be that that one marigold was close to a rock or someplace else where the slugs have been spending the daytime, and it was just the first available plant to feed on. So
he should go out there with a flashlight before dawn tomorrow morning, look
right
up under the leaves and see what's crawling around?
The other thing you often see, if you look carefully enough, slugs usually leave a little bit of a slime trail behind, and so sometimes you can see that either on the underside or the top surface of the leaf, and that would help verify it. But as they said, marigolds, other than earwigs, are really pretty non-insect prone. I'm really somewhat limited to what kind of critters I would normally expect to bother it.
All right. Let's go to the phones again. Scott in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Scott.
How are you doing?
Very good.
I got a couple questions, both about bees. One, last year, kind of just bad misfortune, I was mowing the lawn and I got into a nest of ground bees and got stung up and down my legs and hands. And then the next day I went out to finish the mowing, and I got to the other side of the yard and got into another nest of ground bees and got stung all over again. And I was just wondering how to get rid of them, and I was listening to the call before about a dusting. Is that probably the best way?
Yeah, I find 7 garden dust works well, but what you normally do is wait until 7, 8 o'clock at night. When the bees are, in fact, you probably had yellow jackets, if I'm guessing, which are basically a paper wasp that lives in the ground. But you dust the entrance. We talk to people who try gasoline and try various liquid sprays, and they really don't work very well. What the dust does is it basically coats the entrance, and when they come and go, they get the dust on their bodies, and that's what does them in. Doing it during the middle of the day presents a problem because the workers that are out foraging, when they come back, will refuse to go in the nest and they get pretty agitated. So you can honestly, in the short run, make it worse if you don't treat it at the right time. You do have the option of treating right away in the morning at sunup. I mean, you got to be there pretty early because as soon as they see some light, they're out flying. As I said, usually a garden dust and 7 is the easiest one to find would be the way to go. If it was a very big hole, sometimes it's worth, putting a cotton ball or an old shirt or something to. You don't want to totally plug it, but what you want to do is restrict the opening enough that the critters have to walk through the dust. I mean, that's what it's all about. The dust in contact will do them in pretty short order.
Will they use the same nest every year?
No. They use old rodent burrows and the like. They start from scratch in the spring. A new queen starts everything, and there's no allegiance to the nest. We think this is an evolutionary behavior because if there's a disease and you go back to the nest, you pick it up. And so that's why we think they start everything from scratch, at least in North America. My colleague Bob Jean, who works with these things in the tropics, they behave somewhat differently. But here, everything's from scratch, and they do not come back to the nest, and they do not survive the winter other than the inseminated queens.
Okay, and then Another question, I seen a couple of them last year, and I thought I was just seeing a weird dragonfly, but then I seen one just again a couple days ago. It's jet black. It looks like some kind of wasp or hornet, but it has a really long tail. It's segmented, and it curls like a scorpion tail.
It may not be a dragonfly. We have a very impressive, two or three species of ichneumonid wood wasps that their body itself can be upwards of almost 2 inches, and then you add this long egg-laying device, which is 3 to 4 inches, and it's curled up. They have relatively clear wings that are reminiscent of a dragonfly. And what these things do is attack especially horntails and other wood-destroying critters, and they use this egg-laying device that looks like a stinger to go into the wood and lay their eggs. So that would be one thought. There is a critter called a scorpion fly that we see, and it has it doesn't really have a stinger, but it has a bulbous end in the back. So there's a small chance it's that, but I'm real suspicious. Again, you saw one of these ichneumonid wasps.
Yeah, I mean, it was huge, and actually, what I seen the other day, I was out in the garden, it kind of flew by me, and I was watching, and the thing came straight back for me, so I swatted it and hit it with my hat, but
yeah,
but I couldn't find it again. It got up and flew away.
Well, in particular, this is one that looks extremely scary, but it's absolutely harmless to people. I mean, it's not a true stinger. Although to look at it, you'd swear it could go right to your heart. Typically we see them a lot around firewood. In fact, sometimes you'll also see walking in the woods that when they try to lay their eggs, their ovipositor gets stuck and they're just hanging dead from the trees. It's one of the more impressive Wisconsin insects. So that would be my suspicion, what you saw.
Okay, great.
Well, all right, Scott, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our guest, Phil Pelletieri. And let's move on to Tomahawk. And Tom, hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is about wood ticks. I've never seen so many. I've been coming to northern Wisconsin for many decades, and I keep track of how many I pick off me. At this point, I'm up to 33, seven of which were deer ticks.
Okay.
My question is, what do you guys do? Right now, I have a mosquito suit on. I'm outside.
Mm-hmm.
And sprayed my legs with DEET and only had one get on the back of my hand this morning. That's one question. How do you avoid them if possible? And secondly, what do you do to treat yourself once they have started chewing on you?
Okay. You're not the first person to tell me that their impression is the tick numbers are extremely high. And I get a couple of those calls every year and say, oh, well, you know, maybe it's just the spot you are. But I've pretty well been convinced that they are in high numbers, both deer ticks and in wood ticks. Honestly, when I get in very bad situations, I do something very similar. The mosquito suit is a possibility. I tend to more likely use the permethrin clothing sprays rather than the DEET. And the reason for that is the tick will die. It's sold as a repellent, but it really is an acaricide. And so if the tick walks on my jeans after I've treated it, it's going to die before it gets an opportunity to burrow in. And especially with deer ticks, with this delayed feeding that's required in order to transmit Lyme disease, I know the tick, even if I miss it, will die before it's got an opportunity to transmit the disease. The other advantage of the clothing spray is that when I spray my jeans, you know, tomorrow when I put the same pair of jeans, or if you got work clothes on, coveralls type of thing, you don't have to respray. The spray will last for a number of days. In fact, probably until you do a good clothing wash. Whereas the DEET product that you put on your skin, sometimes you have to reapply two or three times. Now, as far as removal, what you have to remember about a tick's mouth part, it's a lot like your thumb, and it's barbed like a fish hook. Now, in the case of wood ticks, it's a much shorter mouth part. In the case of deer ticks, it's very long. And then on top of that, the deer tick, given the opportunity, glues this mouth part in. And so that's why they're so hard to remove. Some work done a few years ago at Ohio State looking at a lot of the home remedies, putting Vaseline on, burning them with a match, putting olive oil on them. Basically came to the conclusion it doesn't matter what you put on them. It's not going to make a difference in the way they dislodge. And so the recommendation is normally to go and grab them as close to that mouth part as you can in a slow, steady pull. If you've had a deer tick that's been on you for a while, what you will often find is that the hypostome breaks off. That's the equivalent of having a sliver. Little bit of a concern about secondary infection, but not much more than that. And some people will, you know, try to get a pin or a very fine tweezers to remove that, or typically what happens in a day or two, it'll kind of work its way out. Yeah, we just kind of grab it. There is even some very interesting tick pullers that have come out on the market. They're specialized tweezers that you can often get at various pharmacies that are made so that they can, again, get right down there towards the base and grab the tick from that point and then pull steady. So,
would you say again the name of the product?
The clothing spray is, the active ingredient is permethrin, and it's sold under Permanone is one of the names. I tend to be more successful at finding this at sporting goods than I do at drugstores. Some of that has to do with marketing issues, but there are various other brand names, but it will have that same active ingredient. We had talked about this chemical used for spraying for lady beetles and other things, but this stuff is formulated specially just for clothing. It's not labeled for your skin. It's sold as a repellent, but the truth of the matter, it kills ticks. It doesn't repel them.
All right. Well, I'm going to drive into town and get it before they get my truck.
Okay.
Tom, thanks very much, and good luck to you. Our number for your call is 263-1890 in Madison, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Phil Pelletieri about insects and insect life, and I know that lots of people are going to be hearing a certain sound this summer.
It doesn't even do it justice. This one is crickets. But the one that I'm waiting for is the cicadas down in southeast Wisconsin. And I know there's been a lot of press. I guess a couple comments I'd like to make is that if they weren't there in 1990, they will not be there this time, for those of you that have been in an area for a while. So we don't see them in Madison. But boy, the intensity of the calls and the sheer number of bugs are well worth it. I mean, I know some people don't like insects, but I'm going to make at least one special trip, if not a couple, down to southeast Wisconsin to see what's going on. And we're going to hear what's going on in Chicago in very short order. Somebody had predicted they were coming out on the 22nd of May, which I found absolutely amazing what the science was behind that. And they didn't, or at least not in big numbers. There's been some activity, I know. But I'm anticipating, at least in Wisconsin, it's going to be another week or so. They need a certain soil temperature to really get going, and I just don't think it's been warm enough. In 1990, it was really about the 15th to 20th of June before it really started to get impressive down in the Lake Geneva area and Kenosha and Racine and some of those sites.
Somebody emailed us to find out whether or not it would be a scene in the Madison area.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And you know, what's deceptive is if you go to some of the range maps, I heard about a pocket in the Mazamani area in 1990. I don't know, unfortunately, exactly where it is. I know they were very active. My friend Carl Legler talked about a very impressive population at Wyalusa State Park over in Grant County. I know there's a little pocket up in Richland County. But, you know, Dane County, Jefferson County, even Milwaukee has been anticipating it. And we don't have a lot of records of big time numbers in Milwaukee. You have to head a bit south from there. And whereas, again, I can guarantee you the forest preserves of Illinois are going to be very impressive once this starts to roll. So they said that the range maps may give you the impression that they're going to be everywhere, and some of the articles in the paper give you the same impression. But if you grew up in an area and you don't remember as a kid, you're not going to see them this time.
So along the Wisconsin-Illinois border, let's say Rock County, Greene County, those are counties that...
Much more likely.
Likely to be within the territory.
And even Janesville, we didn't see them, but south of Janesville, I heard of some pockets. And so as I said, it's something you will not miss it if you're out on a sunny day. The one thing about their calling, they're more active in the morning, and then they start to subside a little bit in the late afternoon, which is kind of the exact opposite of our dog day cicadas that really get going in the late afternoons and really are quite quiet in the morning. But as I said, it's an experience that, I remember as a kid in growing up in Madison, I didn't have the opportunity to see this, but I was so jealous because one of the kids that was in school had been down in Iowa, and he came in with his little box and opened it up with it in cotton, but there was about 6 or 7 specimens, and he told us, of course, how rare it is. Well, it's rare for 16 years, but that 17th year, you can get them by the bushel basket. And as I said, I've teased people. They think I'm exaggerating, but it's like a science fiction movie. If you have not experienced it, you have no idea.
Well, how about the sound of the annual cicada? Now, we'll see some annual cicadas in the Madison area,
right,
or other parts of Wisconsin.
In fact, to be honest, we have 8 species of cicadas in the state, and they have different calling patterns. And that's interesting because I remember there's a species we get down in Iowa that has a much more of a high-low buzz that kind of goes on and off. And I'm used to hearing it down there. And a couple of years ago in my backyard, all of a sudden I heard one, which was quite unusual. It's one that is not that common in Wisconsin. So once you learn to recognize the species calls, you don't even have to see them. You can pick it from there. And I know Jim's got a book that just came out that I have not had an opportunity to buy a copy, but I've heard great things. It's called The Song of Insects.
Right.
And it goes into quite a bit of detail. But, you know, in this day and age, aside from the book, they give you a CD with all the calls. And that's, Jim was sharing some of those with us. And that's a book that I am going to chase down. And I'm delighted that finally somebody went into enough detail that you can separate, as I said, the tree crickets and the common field crickets and all these other things by listening, and then they give you a pretty good idea of the different ways these insects make some of these sounds.
And Will Hirschberger joined Lang Elliott, the recordist, on this. He's a wonderful photographer, so you have just some amazing up-close and very detailed pictures, full color, of the insects that are being described, all 78 of them, I believe, right, there are.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about the 17-year cicadas is that there really are 8 species. And in Wisconsin, although we only have one population that's brood 13, we have 2 species that will emerge. And if you get into northern Illinois, there are really a 3rd species that shows up, which is quite interesting that these insects, even though they're different species, have evolved to all emerge at the same time, which you know, we theorize it's a way of getting away from predation and other things, but it's just an amazing pattern. And in the southern part of the U.S., they go down to 13 years. There are 13-year cicadas and 17-year cicadas. Why there isn't a 15-year, who knows?
Yeah. So we're brood 13.
Brood 13 of the
17-year cicada cycle.
Right.
All right. Let's go back to the phones for Phil Pelletieri, your UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and to Sandy in Wausau next. Hi, Sandy.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hey, Phil, I have a comment for you. I don't know if you listened to Kathleen's last hour talking to the guys with the bees.
Yeah, I didn't have an opportunity. I was walking over to the radio station, so
yeah,
I missed it.
Well, why don't you give your callers some advice on how to live with insects instead of killing everything? Isn't that the problem with our bees?
Well, the bees, it is such a complex problem in not just this colony collapse disorder. You know, honeybees are quite interesting to me as an entomologist because they're not a native insect. You know, they're from Europe. It is an insect that humans can manipulate, and we have to a great advantage. And normally people, I think have kind of a fondness for honeybees. What I find people don't understand is literally we have hundreds of different species of bees in Wisconsin alone. Most of them don't live in colonies, but yet they still do very, very positive things. But on the other hand, the caller earlier talked about ground bees. Well, they weren't even bees. They were ground wasps. And I've come to the conclusion long ago that for the most part, the general public are not going to be fond of insects. You just kind of have to sit and tolerate that. Although I will say, and I've said this to many people, one of the things I enjoy about doing public radio is the listeners tend to be more on the positive side. They want to know about the biology. They appreciate things like dragonflies and some of those other things. And, from an entomological perspective, we tell people, whether you want to admit it or not, insects are in control of the world. They have been that way for about 300 million years. There are more species of insects than any other creatures that are out there. And no matter what fancy chemicals and nasty things we come up with, we have never made an insect extinct with these things, which kind of gives you the final impression, as I said, they're in control and you better learn to live with them because you're not going to beat them.
Huh. Well, that's not the advice you're giving everybody. And I think everybody should just learn to live with the insects. You know, we are so despicable to begin with. Let the insects live. We ought to be the ones to be exterminated.
Well, if we exterminate ourselves, we know the insects will be taking advantage of it. It's a relative thing. I guess what you have to appreciate is people's difference in tolerance. I mean, I have had people tell me if one insect walks in their bed, an earwig walks in their bed, they'll never sleep in it again. Now, from my perspective, that's not very realistic, but I do know people that have enough fear of insects. And that's unfortunate because, maybe they had a bad experience as a kid. They got stung or, there are a handful of insects that can bite. But generally, I think if people had any appreciation of how many insects are really crawling around out there in their backyard or in their house, it may be somewhat shocking, but then you also realize that many of these things are really very important to the world because of what they do. And again, bees would be a classic example. We're so dependent on their pollination services. And we tell people that it's only about 1% to 2% of the insects you could define as true pests. The other ones are either neutral from a human perspective or doing beneficial things.
Sandy, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate your thoughts and your call. Regarding the honeybees in the state, there is still some question or not whether or not colony collapse has come to Wisconsin.
Right. There was a very interesting article this morning in the State Journal of a beekeeper over in the Darlington area that has some very suspicious symptoms that are very suggestive of colony collapse disorder. The State Department of Ag bee inspectors have been to the property, taken some notes and information, and I would not be surprised if this will be an official diagnosis. But you have to sort through so much because of the varroa mites and other complications that beekeepers have worked with. Just the sheer loss of bees could be related to winter, pesticide use, a number of things. But again, the symptoms of the way that the colonies are behaving and the loss of bees are real suspicious. And most of the stuff we'd been hearing about previous had to do with migratory beekeepers, and we do know that one of the precursors of colony collapse seems to be some kind of stress, and migratory beekeepers do stress the bees when they're moving them around. The other very interesting thing, though, is that generally speaking, from what I'm hearing, is it was a pretty good winter for those that kept bees here, and so that was exciting. We often experience a 20 or 30% colony loss just to winter issues. Because this is can be a pretty harsh climate for bees. And the other thing this is forcing us to do, I think, is to sit back and try to get a better understanding and appreciation of native pollinators in case, indeed, we do come to a point that honeybees are in more trouble than they are already. I think, you know, the factors of losing about half our bees in the last 30 years, honeybees in particular, but that's a whole complex of things. There's economics involved. There's labor issues involved. There are these new mites, new diseases, medications that are needed. I said beekeeping has gotten to be it's always been hard work, but now it's also taking an awful lot of what I call babysitting of the bees, of a special care in order to keep the colony strong.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest today as we talk about insects like cicadas, honeybees, gypsy moss, and we'll take your phone calls in just a moment. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about insects with Phil Pelletieri. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. And, Phil, someone emailed us with a question about whether we should be trying to protect small trees or vegetable gardens ahead of the arrival of cicadas.
Sure. Not too worried about the vegetable gardens. The one thing you see in these places where we have these incredibly high populations is when cicadas lay their eggs, they have a knife-like device they use to slit into small twigs, and they'll create a maybe 1.5 to 2-inch gash and then lay their eggs inside that, and they fall. Well, if you've got 20 of them on a small branch, you can see 20 slits. And so what you tend to get is what we would define as flagging, small branches that dry out and die back. Now, on a big oak tree or something like that, that's insignificant. In fact, I even saw one quote on an apple tree, even though you get a short run of problem, this kind of self-pruning causes more flowering and potentially more fruit down the road. Where I would be concerned is if I had a 2-foot crab apple I just put out, you know, that is not going to tolerate a lot. So there are, I think, certain circumstances where trees may have to be covered with floating row cover or a light screening. But generally speaking, that's not needed. And again, it depends all where you are. I hate to see people lose too much sleep on this in areas that we do not see the cicadas.
Back to the phones we go, Phil. Let's go to Joe in Manitowoc next. Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I've got two questions, actually. In the spring, actually throughout the year, we get these little black and red bugs. They're pretty flat, about 3/8 to a quarter of an inch long, or 3 to 1/2 inch long, somewhere in that range. Any idea what those might be? We get them by, like, the ladybug type flocks of them.
What I'm guessing is they're immature nymphs of the box elderbug, because they would fit that description. And of course, the adult looks a little bit different because it's got fully grown wings. And in the last 2 years, the box elderbug numbers have been high, and people have seen them all over their yards and gardens, and maybe the side of the house, and in a little confused, thinking they might feed on their plants. And what I'm finding is they're feeding on the box elder and silver maple seeds on the ground, because that's what this insect is a seed feeder. And in the dry years that we've been having, box elder bugs do well in dry years. And so I have had quite a few inquiries and samples come in that would fit that description that turned out to be nymphal or immature box elder bugs.
Okay. Is there any worry about them, because they're always like on the siding and they're inside between the patio, the screen door and the front door?
No, I mean, the only problem that they present is in the fall of the year, the adults will migrate in and they create a nuisance. And, you know, if you're in the wrong spot, they can literally come in by the hundreds. And it's a little bit of how tight the house is sealed. If they can get in, you know, if they just get under the siding but can't get into the walls, then that's all that happens. And then on a sunny day, they kind of wake up and move. In the worst case scenario, if you've got an old leaky farmhouse, then, you know, every warm day in the winter, a couple box elder bugs kind of come out and crawl around. But that's the extent of it. They don't bite. They don't really damage anything. Once in a while, they leave a little bit of a waste spot, but that's relatively minor. And again, if really what will determine where their numbers go, there's two generations a year, but we find fall rains and fall humidity tend to create a fungus disease that just knocks the population down. It's when we have these dry falls and the populations start high that we have the worst problems with them. So the weather will determine more than anything else. And again, it depends more what's happening in August and early September than what we're seeing now.
And the other one, I guess, was it's like a giant mosquito. It's not what you get, the caller previously was talking about, but it looks like a big mosquito, and it's got a really long stinger type thing coming down. And I never thought there were anything to them, but my wife got stung by one the other day. She said it hurt pretty good, but not like a bee sting or anything. But
Okay. Well, normally when people call about giant mosquitoes, there's a group of flies we call crane flies, and they're related to mosquitoes, and they have huge long legs and the same kind of wing structure, but they have no stinger and they don't have a biting mouth part. So I'm not quite sure if she got zapped, I would be more inclined to think it comes something out of the wasp group, because those are the only critters that really have that mechanism in order to cause pain. You know, the biting flies are more things like deer flies and the like, and I think people would recognize if that's what she was experiencing.
Yeah, no, they just look like really big mosquitoes. They got really long, dangly legs, and then like a big proboscis, or not a proboscis, but a big stinger-like thing coming out of the back of them.
Yeah, boy, I'd be happy if you got a picture of it. Again, what I find is a lot of the wood wasps and other things look quite scary, but their stingers are made for laying eggs, not a true stinger. So I'm really not quite sure what got her.
All right, Joe, thanks very much, and good luck on your hunt for that particular insect. Let's go next to Christian in Oshkosh. Hi, Christian.
Hello. You were talking earlier about things being a little bit ahead of schedule. And just as you said that, I saw a monarch butterfly fly through my backyard. So is that ahead of schedule, or is that on time? Or
well, that depends on southerly wind flows. I saw my first monarch yesterday, too, out in our backyard on one of the flowers. And it really depends. If we get a good, strong southerly airflow, we can get monarchs up here in early May even. So that's a good sign. They don't want to get up here too early because there's no milkweed out for them to lay eggs. But, a lot of the stuff is up now. And so if all other things being equal, we may have a good monarch year. Again, it is somewhat weather dependent, but there are some years that I seem not to see the first monarch, I swear, to the 1st of July. So it really is encouraging that we're seeing them this early. But as I said, what you usually have to do is just go back and look at where the weather patterns have been coming from. And some years, you know, it just doesn't warm up. We don't get those good Gulf winds coming up. But once they do, the monarchs can really move up here quite quickly. The ones we're seeing here now, though, didn't come from Mexico. This is their offspring that have been breeding in Texas and some of the southern states and moving up from there.
Thank you.
All right, Christian, thank you very much. And you'll want to be with us a week from now, next Wednesday at 11 o'clock, as we talk with Paul Weber of Duluth, who writes a great science teacher and writes a number of books. And he's got the Butterflies of Wisconsin and the North Woods. So that'll be a program that you'll want to take part in. Scott's in Green Bay. You're next. Hi, Scott.
I've got some issues with, I believe they're fire ants, the red and black little ants, and they're pretty much surround the perimeter of my home.
Okay, yeah. What I think you got is what we would call field ants, because fire ants are not here, but field ants bite. And they also will then turn around and spray formic acid on the bite, which makes it burn. They are notorious in some cases for making huge mounds. And they're not an ant that typically comes indoors, so they're not a kitchen problem. But I always tell people it is not what you want to set your picnic blanket over, because, again, they will cause you some problems. So is it just a couple big nests, or are they just seem to be everywhere?
Oh, they're everywhere, and it's part of where we live, I know. I'm really looking just to see if there's something I can at least go around the perimeter of the home to at least allow us to go in and out without having them crawl up our legs right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, what happens with a lot of the sprays, when they call this a barrier treatment, when you go around the outside foundation, and the interesting thing is ants avoid these sprays more than are killed. And so it's more of a behavioral change. And so this is what pest control firms will do to stop ants from coming indoors. I always tell people it's somewhat cosmetic. I mean, it's not like you're wiping the ant colony out, but you're stopping them from coming in, which is what a lot of people are after. So any of the products that you can get at the local hardware store or the like, the ant sprays, the home pest control sprays, all those things work about the same. And usually what you do is you treat from the ground level out a couple feet and maybe up 5 or 6 inches. Probably the one place, if they've been coming in, and again, that's not an issue with this ant, is important to treat that little spacing between where your siding meets the foundation. And if you can spray up in there, it both is the avenue that many of them use to get in, but also the spray lasts a lot longer because it's protected from weathering.
Our big issue is more like around the driveway and just getting to the vehicles and things, where they seem to be coming in from around the grass and things.
Sure. So. Well, there, as I said, you could probably just spray where the driveway ends and where the grass starts, just a little band. And as I said, what you're going to see is the ants just don't want to cross that band. In fact, people don't even have to use, I've seen people use wintergreen oil and other natural products to get a similar effect. It's anything that's somewhat foreign that the ants seem to kind of back off from. Ants are very sensitive to things and like that. Now, the problem with wintergreen oils, I don't know how long it's going to last. Whereas some of these sprays, I would expect or treatments to last 3 to 4 weeks.
Scott, thanks very much for your call. Good luck to you. And let's go to Bill next. And Bill, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I've got two questions. One is, when we built this house, we built the dug the foundation, we had an extra little room put on with just a doorway. And that became our front porch because they capped it. And it's a wine cellar now. Every once in a while, I see a little sawdust on the shelves. It looks like sawdust anyway, but very, very fine. Mm-hmm. Is that carpenter ants?
Well, you know, if it was as fine as talcum powder, then I would be suspicious. It's powder post beetle, which is an insect that would get into rough-hewn beams and the like. If it's a little coarser, then it would be, although one of the things you will see if you look very closely at carpenter ant frass, which is what we call that sawdust, is little bits and pieces of insect legs and other parts. It's really kind of like their garbage pile, and they just throw all this stuff out. And because they are primarily insect feeders, you often get this mixture. And so that's when people send me little flakes of insulation and whatnot, I'm looking for this additional evidence to make sure that it is indeed carpenter ants. I do see other ants on occasion, especially if the wood has been softened, excavate it and kick a little bit of frass out. But carpenter ants would be the most likely.
Could I put around the foundation? Would putting Dursban help?
Again, what it would do is stop the you from seeing ants. But what I would try to figure out here, I mean, if the sawdust is ending up on a shelf, I would look above it or to the side of it to see where it's getting kicked from. To be honest, that's enough of an evidence to suggest where the nest is that you may be able to get away with just spot treating one spot and solving the problem, rather than treating that outside perimeter, which really doesn't solve the problem. As I said, it just kind of stops you from seeing ants.
Okay, but what, like seven?
Seven or Dursban.
Okay,
you know, it isn't, this is a case of, it really is where you put it more than what you use.
Okay, and the other question is with ticks. You were recommending you spray clothes. I read an article that says anytime you want to deter insects, mosquitoes or ticks or anything else, you get a little anise oil and put it into your sprayer. Hmm. Have you ever heard that?
Well, again, I bet you anise oil would repel ants big time. I'm not sure what the mosquito would be affected by. You know, one of the things that's happened in the last 4 or 5 years is we've seen more natural product types of mosquito materials come out. There's been work, but not registration yet, on catnip is a pretty good mosquito repellent. There are some eucalyptus oils that are now marketed as a natural product. There's even a soybean oil mix that is quite effective. To be honest, those things probably, I mean, I know they're tested, so there's some basis of using that. I'm a little leery on the anise oil, both because if you've ever gotten close to anise oil and got it on your lips or whatnot, it really can burn. And I'm not sure it's effective. So that one I'm a little more hesitant, although, as I said, I can see where it would repel some things. The tick's the same thing. I mean, what DEET does is it prevents blood-feeding insects from recognizing you as something to eat. It goofs up their receptors. To be honest, we don't understand the mechanisms of some of these plant oils, other than to know that they work, but it must be a similar thing. What I often find is people often associate things that are strong smelling and tasting to us as being strong smelling and tasting or repellent to insects. And you got to remember that they do have different sensory systems. And so sometimes I'm a little bit leery about some of the home remedies.
Bill, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. We're going to check up with the latest news and find out what's going on in the world. And then we will be back to take your calls. Guest Phil Pelletieri, and the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. We do have callers on the line. Hope they'll stay with us. They'll be first in line when we start up after the news here on the Ideas Net. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Phil Pelletieri is here in studio, UW-Madison professor of entomology and an entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison, as we talk about insects. And one of the things we've been talking about today have been the 17-year cicada. Let's see if we can develop some of that sound of what people will be hearing later on this summer. Is that like music to your ears, Phil?
Oh, that's the sound I remember.
So that's the 17-year cicada, and that's the whole chorus
of
them. It's
the chorus of what you'd expect in a woodlot that has some pretty good population densities. And you know, there's the songs are really quite complicated. The males have a courting song. The females have kind of a wing buzz answer. But when you put all this together, as I said, it is a chorus. There's no other way to put it.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest. Our number in Madison, 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones, and Frank starts us up in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Yes, I apologize if you've already covered this topic, but I haven't been listening right along. I've been trying to get through on the phone. Anyway, my problem is, our lawn seems to be, not so much right now, but as of about a month ago, infested with ants. And they seem to have sort of disappeared. I guess I'm just wondering, is there something I should do about it? And if so, what?
Well, I mean, ants themselves, people I think would be amazed at the density of ants in the normal lawn. A lot of things like cornfield ants and whatnot make such small mounds and don't bother you that definitely, I mean, they don't hurt the grass. In fact, you can probably argue they help to aerate it. Plus, many ants do feed on insects and the like, and so there's that benefit. Where we get a trouble, and a caller earlier had talked about these field ants, which can make huge mounds. They're so big that they literally bury the grass.
The anthills were quite substantial in size.
Yes. And so I guess, you know, when they start getting big enough to interfere with the lawnmower and those kind of things, I can see why people want to deal with them. And the issue there is that there is a queen that's quite far down in the ground, and your success or failure in control is to get at her. And so what I suggest to people is to get some kind of metal rod or something that you can poke down in there and make 3 or 4 good channels. And you'll often find the ground is quite loose because they have it all chambered and excavated anyway. And then mix up whatever you've got around. I mean, most garden insecticides have registration for use on lawns for ants. So things like 7 and malathione and permethrin and bifenthrin, and it's a long list of things. And usually what works is to mix it up in a milk carton you know, to normal dilution rates of a teaspoon to a gallon or whatever they suggest,
yeah. Uh-huh.
And then pour it on in so that it soaks down in. And the whole point is that we're getting it deep enough to likely get the queen. Sometimes what I'll suggest for people is you can even take a rake and rake some of that ant soil away, first of all, do the treatment, and then this untreated soil you can cap right over the top so you don't even have any exposed insecticide. But it's all about what we would call drenching, getting it deep enough to do what you want it to do. And so you kind of spot treat these big nests, and that should do it for you.
Okay. So having the whole lawn treated commercially is not necessarily the answer.
No, in fact, what you will get is a short-term, boy, I don't see any ants, but then whether it's a week or 6 weeks later, they're right back at you. And that comes from this fact that we had talked about before, is the chemical has got some repellency to it, so the ants really kind of go underground and lay low, but once the chemical starts to dissipate, they'll be right back at you. And you may have killed a few workers, but they're sterile females. They're really not important to kill. As I said, in order to deal with ants, you have to kill the queen. And in this case, you have to get deep enough to do the job.
Frank, good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. And on to Brandy in Lake Mills. Hello, Brandy.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for having your guest on. I'm calling today with a comment and a question. My comment is just a little tidbit of information. I was reading in Eva Crane's book about beekeeping, and she's mentioning that the archaeological record with the Mayan Indians indicate that they did have a honeybee that originated independently from the Old World. I found that interesting. I thought all honeybees were from the Old World, but this is a species that she mentions in here, and that they relied a lot upon the honey then.
Do you remember if they call it Apis mellifera, or was it a different species of Apis?
The one listed here is Meliopona beechi or something like
okay.
that.
So it's a different, it's a totally different species.
Yes. And then my other question, it's something that I had just come across with the cicada information coming out, that with the abundance of them on those on the 17-year abundance, that dogs and squirrels often eat them. But I'd also heard mentioned that some people roast them and eat them, and I'm wondering if that's true, if you've ever heard of that.
Oh, yes. In fact, it seems, I remember 1990, the recipes in the Chicago Tribune of garlic fries and all this other stuff. And, you know, what typically, if somebody were serious about that, is to catch the nymphs when they're coming out of the ground, because they will both be more tender and whatnot, or when the adults recently emerge before their skin tends to harden. I mean, the problem with an adult cicada is that, you know, there is this very much plastic-like exoskeleton in the wings, which are not edible or digestible. And so, yeah, we always see these recipes. You know, the thing that will benefit from these are birds that are insect feeders. This is all of a sudden a great wealth of protein available. And so it would not surprise me that in some of these areas that the bird broods will be higher and more successful just because of the improved diet. And so there are benefits. In fact, I also remember reading an article where somebody was waiting for all these dead skins. They tended to mulch them up and put in the garden as a natural fertilizer. And I'm sure, again, that would work. It's a great source of nitrogen when you get those kind of densities.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Brandy, thank you very much for your call. And on to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I might be in some trouble. I used to live in Michigan about 2 years ago, and my in-laws still live up there. And my father-in-law thought he was going to do me a big favor, and he gave me a bunch of wood from up there. And okay. As far as I know, it's against the law to bring the wood back.
Now, this was from the UP?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the good news is that there's no emerald ash borer in the UP.
That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
But the way the it's working now is when a state becomes quarantined, and the quarantine, as far as I'm aware, is only in the southern part of the state, but no firewood out of southern Michigan, Indiana, honestly, out of Illinois anymore. The state of Illinois has been quarantined because of their two populations. And you will see an awful lot of concerted effort by the Department of Ag and the DNR to educate campers in particular. Where we're most nervous about these headaches coming to us is in infested firewood. And so, as I said, the good news is being out of the UP, there's no beetles there to bring here. But in general, we're suggesting to utilize firewood locally okay. that you know doesn't have these kind of problems.
Can I burn that wood then? Or?
Oh, yes.
Okay. I just didn't want to spread anything that would destroy my backyard and all that good stuff.
Yeah. No, as they said, it's really ash that's the concern right now, although the ban is on all firewood, or it can be certified. There are ways they can kiln dry the wood. There are ways they can debark it. There's two or three mechanisms, and then they get a certification, a USDA certification to move it. But without those certifications, it's not legal.
Phil, as long as we have the opportunity, what's the status of the emerald ash borer these days? Still holding tight south of Illinois?
The Department of Ag is continuing to do their trap tree survey. And, you know, in fact, I think there's a public information campaign coming out this next week, trying to get people, especially, as I said, right now, I think that the main thing is to try to get people to understand this firewood issue and the potential problems there. But knock on wood, we have not seen a positive in the state.
All right, Nick, thank you very much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation with Phil Pelletieri, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Lisa in Madison next. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Last fall, I had asked how to cut down on the lady, what they call Asian beetles and box elder bugs. Mm-hmm. And you had given me two dates, I think September 1st and October 1st. And each one had a different date of when to spray around the perimeter of the house. And I did that. You said to use a micro encapsulated pyrethamine, and it worked. I'm down to like 80% less than last year.
Good.
So thank you.
All right.
Yep.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. It's always nice to hear some successful results. And on to Paul next in Duluth. And Paul, what can we do for you?
Well, you can give me hope for the future. you mentioned tent caterpillars briefly a few times. I moved here in 2000, and in 2002, I had an invasion of tent caterpillars that almost made me move.
Yeah, you had an outbreak of forest tent caterpillar in your
neck. They covered my deck and. They got on my dog, and she carried him in the house. I was finding him in the bedroom. It was awful. Are they cyclical, or do they, are we anticipating another major, literally all the trees around here, it looked like the middle of January mm-hmm. by the time they get done with them.
Mm-hmm. They are cyclical, but not one that you can predict. You know, it's not like it's a five-year cycle or a seven-year cycle. Historically in Wisconsin, it's often been closer to a 20-year cycle that we've seen, although I will tell you there are forest tent caterpillar outbreaks in Minnesota, in parts of Ontario, somewhere going on all the time. And so what typically happens is it seems that their natural parasites get out of sync. They go crazy for a couple, 3 years before the parasites catch up, and then things settle down again. And so that's been the normal pattern. And trying to understand when these outbreaks come isn't real easy, although to be honest, the DNR does look at these things. They know where the hot spots will be, but it's only the year before type of thing. And as I said, if we go back on historical records, I think it's probably going to be another 10 to 15 years before you see another outbreak, would be my guess.
You made me a happy man.
All right, Paul.
But one other point about that. So you say that there is a natural parasite that keeps them under control.
Well, more than one, but the one that gets the most press, and it's a very interesting one, the people call it the government fly or the friendly fly. It looks very similar to a house fly. It is given the name government fly because people thought the DNR released it or something similar, and that's not true. These are both native insects. Friendly fly from the fact that they kind of land on you and they don't want to get off you. And so what you will see is you get an outbreak of tent caterpillar, and then all of a sudden, 1 year that the friendly flies show up, you know that within a year you're going to get a crash in the population. They also have virus diseases. They have little wasp parasites. They all do play an important role here too. But as I said, it's this sarcophagid friendly fly that we see that is the predictor. When the friendly flies show up, I know we're on the downswing of the population.
Those are big flies, right?
Yeah, a little bigger than a house fly and a little bit more bristly, but they remind people of a big... In fact, they come from a group of flesh flies that we normally associate with dead animals.
Aha! You've made me a happy man today.
All right, Paul. Yeah. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. We had an email from Doris. She had received some email information about tick removal. And the information is to apply liquid soap to a cotton ball, hold the soaked cotton ball over the tick for 20 seconds. When you remove it, the tick will be sticking to the cotton ball.
Again, knowing how their mouth parts function, it sounds like the tick was not attached to begin with, because with that barbed mouth part, there's no way they can release it quickly. It's not like you're clamping on with your hand and the like. And as I said, I really go back to the work done at Ohio State where they took the ticks, did all the various home remedies, and their final conclusion is none of these remedies really helped in dislodging attached ticks. And the one question they raised, and I wouldn't worry about it, the soap, but anytime you're introducing something foreign, you're increasing the chance of infections.
On to John in Black River Harbor next. Hi, John.
Hey, good afternoon, Jim Packard and Phil. Hey, I have a couple questions about lightning bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was outside last night about 3 o'clock or so in the, at night, and I'm watching these little guys flying around. And I just wondering, the air temperature at the time was 70 degrees. It was windy. And I was wondering, what are their habitat specs? Temperature regimes, light intensity, and, you know, are they active when it's really windy, or do they kind of hunker down? And
sure.
What is their season length?
Well, part of it, you know, it's really a family of beetles. They're a soft-winged beetle, so we call them fireflies. I'm quite intrigued that you're seeing them this early. Normally, I don't expect to see them well into June and then getting into July, but because there are different species, we see differences. They are not overly strong flyers, so I would guess if the wind speeds are up above 15 miles per hour, they're laying into areas that they're not exposed to, because the wind would just blow them down the road if it was. They will be more active at warmer temperatures, but that's an insect thing, being cold-blooded. If, you know, things get down around 60 degrees or less, to be honest, their enzymes in their body doesn't work very well, so that would come into play. I mean, I usually think about it, those nice, warm, humid nights that are kind of still is when they seem to be most active. Most of the flashing goes on just after dusk and for the first couple hours, and then they kind of really settle down in most cases. The immature stages of some of them glow but don't flash, and they are still in that same group or a closely related group, and they're really quite fascinating. We tend to see the immature stage, which are predators, in what I would consider moist woodlots in swampy areas, and then the adults are usually relatively close proximity to that, and it's interesting. So many things in life seemed that they were always so many more when you were younger. And my experience with fireflies, I see more fireflies now than I did when I was younger. And in the Madison area, I wonder, back when I was a kid, we used to fog for mosquitoes. And I think that had a major impact on the fireflies. And we don't do that anymore. And that may be one of the reasons that they have made a comeback.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks for your time. And thank you.
All right, John. Thank you very much. And we're moving on to Janine in Manitowish Waters. Hi, Janine.
Hi. I hope I'm not repeating something you've already said, but I tuned in a little late. Last winter from, say, Thanksgiving beyond Christmas, well into January, I had a terrible problem with the carpenter ants. They were in the kitchen. They were just everywhere. I put out traps, and it seemed to take care of briefly, and then it was back. Then I started finding them in the bathrooms, in the bedroom, finally went up in the crawl space and looked above the kitchen, pulled back the insulation, and found hundreds of nests. I'm talking about maybe a 30-foot span between the 2x4s, and had to slip the plastic insulation and actually put poison underneath there. Plus, really smashed a bunch of ants. I mean, it was horrible. What I'm wondering is, what can I do to prevent this in case I didn't get them all?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is there was only one queen in that colony. She's the only member that can reproduce and lay eggs. And so that's, you know, what's deceptive is you can kill all the ants you want, and they're sterile workers, and if you do not kill the queen, you have not solved the problem. Vice versa, if you kill the queen, you don't have to worry about the rest of the ants because there's no way they can continue breeding, and their population will just crash. And so it's hard to say. One would assume, I mean, you found the nest, and usually when you find the nest and you treat it, you solve your problem. And so the ants that you missed, you know, and with a colony that strong, it would suggest that the ant traps you put out could have been working, but you just didn't have enough feed out there for a long enough time to do the job. Because, again, it all goes back to the queen being killed, and she needs to see enough food and whatever the poison is in the baits to knock her out. And if you've got 30,000 ants, there's lots of other ants in the way that see that food too. And so that's why it takes so much bait. But, you know, it is more direct to do what you do, to do some detective work, because if you find them, you got them. You don't have to worry about the baits in months of attempting to get the control. The other dead giveaway that we knew that they're in your house is, you know, there's no way I can explain carpenter ants, even one or two in your house in December, unless you brought them in on a piece of firewood that's down in the basement, or that you truly have a colony. So that is very important information when you see them in the winter, that they are nesting indoors. One of the other things that we see often is if they're nesting in an outside wall, they often kind of go quiet in January because it's too cold where they are. But then they start waking up in February and March when it starts to warm up again. And I don't see carpenter ants coming in from the outside until we often get it well into April, if not later.
Oh, okay. We also set off a bomb up there to try and take care of more. Is there anything that I should be spraying then around the house?
No, because it's kind of like they took advantage of an environment, and, you know, I'm not to say that won't happen again. One of the things is that colony was at least 4 or 5 years old. I mean, you don't get these kind of numbers in overnight. It takes a long time to build. And so I suspect that they had been quite active there. You know, if I was building a house from scratch, there are some things you could put in the walls, like silica aerogel and other drying agents that would make them somewhat insect-proof. But, you know, we just don't have that kind of insect pressures in this state to justify those kind of treatments. And so, again, I guess I would suggest just keep your eyes open. If you start to see things that are suspicious, then start looking around again. And this comment about them being under the insulation, we're seeing quite a bit of that. I often find in these satellite colonies that move in just for the summer, that sill plate that you have in your basement, that's the area between your foundation and where the flooring goes, there's often this little box. And for energy efficiency, we often stuff it with insulation. What that creates are little pockets. I'm surprised, but it's quite common for those ants to move into those pockets, and that's where the nest is. So I often tell people when they're doing their detective work is, you know, pull back the insulation, see if they're there. If they are, you know where the nest is. You can spot treat it like you did, and hopefully that solves it right there.
Good luck to you, Janine. Thank you very much for your call. And let's try Peter in Gladstone, Michigan. Peter?
I just wanted to make a comment, slash question. I thought that the emerald ash borer was found in Brimley State Park in the UP.
There was one little pocket, as far as I know, that has been contained. And so I think officially Michigan is looking at it that it's not established in the UP.
Okay.
All right, Peter, thank you very much for your call and your inquiry. Marlene in Twin Lakes, let's give you a chance.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A long time ago in science class, I recall, and that's like about 60 years ago, types of mosquitoes, and one was where their legs were up, and they were the kind that would bite you and get your malaria and so on and so forth, yellow fever. I was just trying to remember the name of these types of mosquitoes. I know they started with an A.
It's Anopheles.
Anopheles.
And those are the malaria vectors. And what's interesting is we have Anopheles mosquitoes in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
And to be honest, there is a history of 120 years ago where there were small cases of malaria here. But it's a non-issue. So we still got the right kind of mosquito, but we don't have people running around with the parasites in their blood for the mosquitoes to pick up to spread to someone else. But again, people are usually amazed when we tell them that malaria was an issue, quite an issue in parts of the United States at one time.
Was there another mosquito that started with an A, too?
Well, there's a genus Aedes, which is a very big group of nuisance mosquitoes. In fact, the biggest stinker of the 54 species we have in the state is called Aedes vexans. And so that's the other group. It's Aedes.
Phil, thank you very much for being here. And Marlene, too, thanks for your call as well. We'll look forward to your next appearance with us.
Sounds good.
Phil Pelletieri is a UW-Madison professor of entomology and an entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab in Madison. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production today. Tomorrow at 11, it's The Case for Renewable Energy with Michael Vickerman of Renew Wisconsin. And then New York Times columnist Anahad O'Connor reveals some surprising facts in his book, Never Shower in a Thunderstorm, from Times Books. Thanks for listening. I'm Jim Pack.